for argument this morning is Singer against Ramish. Mr. Herbert.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Turner Herbert with the law firm of Mayer Brown, and I represent plaintiff appellant Kevin Singer by appointment of the Court. Your Honors, this appeal is not about the merits of Mr. Singer's constitutional challenge to a prison regulation, but rather the limits of deference given to prison officials when evaluating that claim at summary judgment. Both this Court and the Supreme Court have made clear that such deference does not supplant the evidentiary presumptions associated with summary judgment. Here, however, the District Court awarded summary judgment to Waupun Prison. This, despite Mr. Singer's introduction of factual testimony from 15 lay and expert witnesses that directly challenged a bare affidavit of a lone prison official.
And speaking of those affidavits,
yes, Your Honor.
How did they really address Moreski's concern that the role-playing games might lead inmates to think about escaping from the correctional environment?
Your Honor, Officer Moreski's affidavit, if I may speak to that first, Mr. Officer Moreski's affidavit made the specific claim that playing Dungeons and Dragons might promote gang-related activity because of a particular rule of the game, and that it allows an authority figure to lord over or rule over subordinate players. And Mr. Singer's personal affidavit addressed that squarely and disputed it and said,
Counsel, you're not answering my colleague's question. She asked about the prison's escapism rationale. And that worried me, too, because your brief doesn't mention it, but it's one of the prison's rationales. How do these affidavits or your submission in general deal with that part of the prison's rationale?
Yes, Chief Easterbrook. Officer Moraski does make reference to his belief that the game might promote escapism. Again, and the point I was trying to make previously was that that concern only arises if the inmates are actually playing the game of Dungeons and Dragons, and that doesn't address the main problem with the prison's prohibition here, which is that it bans the mere possession of these related literary publications.
So I still don't see that as a direct. I mean, that was his big, and that was the thing that gave me pause, this whole escape business. And so whether they're actually physically playing it or not, they certainly know how the game works. I mean, that's
You're
what
right.
I understand the thrust of it to be. And
sure. If I may retreat and just talk just for a moment about what the record talks about with respect to the game itself. You can obviously play the game of Dungeons and Dragons. I don't personally know very much about it, but what is in the record is that it's a role-playing game that is designed to develop stories around fictional characters, played with multiple parties, usually with dice, or often with dice. But separate from the game itself, and here's the important part, separate from the game itself, there's a whole genre of Dungeons and Dragons-related publications that talk about the characters, their novellas or longer works, and tell stories about the characters themselves. And that stands distinct from congregating together with multiple people to play the game. And Mr. Singer's dispute with this prison regulation is that his literary publications that are related to the game of Dungeons and Dragons were confiscated, and that this the prison policy that was later enacted prohibits his possession of those novels and related publications. And so the notion that playing the game might promote escapism is only relevant in the context of playing the game. And here, all Mr. Singer seeks is the return of his, I'll just use the word novels generally, but that is certainly one of the types of publications that relate to the game of Dungeons and Dragons. I mean, the notion of escapism certainly would apply to virtually any novel about a fictional story. We all escape when we read novels, and certainly the prison is not arguing that all novels should be banned from the prison. So I hope to address your question by noting the distinction between playing the game. Yes, sir.
I can note the distinction, all right, but the prison is obviously worried about cooperative activity among prisoners, which might set up rivals for leadership, which might be a cover for planning escapes. One way of cutting down on the amount of cooperative activity among prisoners is to deprive them of the manuals for that cooperation. And if that doesn't seem to have any problems under the rational relation test of Turner. So if you're willing to concede that the prison is entitled to ban the playing of Dungeons and Dragons, why doesn't it follow that the prison can ban the instruction books for playing Dungeons and Dragons?
Well, Chief Easterbrook, it's not just the manuals. And again, I want to make that clear, because unlike most games, Dungeons and Dragons does not have a rule book. It does not have an instruction manual. It has publications that make reference to and incorporate various...
It does have a manual. There is a trademark game called Dungeons and Dragons, and then there's a large secondary literature about it.
You're correct, Your Honor, and I didn't mean to dispute the fact that there's an actual game, of course. But to your question, it's not as if Mr. or Officer Muraski or Walton Prison more generally couldn't prove at trial or even in summary judgment that concern about escapism or authority figures looming over subordinate players has any validity as a security interest. We're not disputing that. Again, that goes to the merits of the case under the Turner standard. Here we're at summary judgment, and so the relevant inquiry is what's on the record? What's on the record for Walpin Prison? And what's on the record before Walpin Prison is a very bare affidavit that makes one reference to escapism and only in the context of playing the game.
Well, and even if Dungeons and Dragons doesn't lead to gang activity, why doesn't the prison have a legitimate interest in prohibiting fantasy role-playing games?
Your Honor, I'm not disputing the fact that they might have a valid constitutional claim to do that. Again, we're here at summary judgment. And in Beard versus Banks, which is 20 years post the Turner standard, is when the court had the occasion to marry that evidentiary standard of Turner with the procedural standards that govern summary judgment. And there the court unmistakably reaffirmed the summary judgment standard. It said the court must draw all justifiable inferences in the inmate's favor. And only then can it determine whether the inmate has raised a genuine factual dispute. Now, the prison won summary judgment in Beard, and I hope this addresses your question. The prison won summary judgment in Beard, and that was because the inmate failed to dispute the facts as put forward by the prison. But that clearly is not the case here. Mr. Singer put forth a trove of compelling factual evidence disputing Walpin's assertion that D&D might promote gang-related activity. Now, whether that's enough to satisfy Turner at trial is a question for another day. But it seems, it is the fact that there can't be any doubt that Mr. Singer is entitled to that day before a jury, because he has raised a genuine issue of material fact that severely undermines the anemic affidavit of Officer Muraski. And summary judgment was therefore unjustified. Again, this is not about whether or not the prison has a legitimate penological interest. It's not about whether they can prove that Dungeons and Dragons is a direct cause of gang-related activity. It's just on the record before us, it's not there. And this court has been very clear, said that a bare assertion, even by a prison official, is insufficient to compel summary judgment in the face of competing evidence. And we have it here in spades. If I may address, Your Honors, the substance of Mr. Singer's evidence is that there was both lay witness and expert witness testimony. Now, the lay witnesses were all either current or former inmates at Walpin, and they had all served extensive prison sentences. And they testified that in their personal experience, they had never heard of a Dungeons and Dragons gang in any prison anywhere, and that they had never observed or heard of a single disruptive incident that was in any way associated with either Dungeons & Dragons or any other role-playing game. Now, the fact that that collective personal knowledge that spans numerous years, many of these prisoners had over 20 years prison time, is certainly probative to the question of whether or not Mr. Muraski's affidavit is reasonably related to its legitimate penological interest of prison safety. In fact, one lay witness was himself an avowed gang member and stated, "I have never met or heard of any gang linked to role-playing games." In addition to the lay witness testimony, Your Honors, there was expert testimony. I'll touch on that just for a moment. There was a certified literacy tutor who obviously teaches people to read, and he testified that in his experience, role-playing games promote reading comprehension and mathematical proficiency. Another expert is an analyst for a role-playing game retailer. It's his job to read and review these sorts of secondary literary publications associated with role-playing games, and he testified that in his opinion, they do not promote violence. And lastly, there was a chair of an international association of role-playing game researchers, half of whose members, I might add, hold advanced degrees. And he testified that the association has never heard of anything resembling a role-playing gang, and that he cited multiple scholarly works that corroborates the use of such games for the treatment of gang activity as well as for the rehabilitation of prisoners. Now, all of that cuts squarely against the anemic evidence put forth by Walpin Prison and Officer Muraski's affidavit. Now, the district court failed to mention this expert testimony at all, and it rejected outright the lay witness testimony. And it did so in reliance on Turner. But that reliance was premature. Again, the relevant inquiry at summary judgment, which Beard makes plain, is whether or not the prisoner has mounted enough evidence to defeat summary judgment. Whether it suffices to under Turner to render it unconstitutional, again, it is a secondary question and an important one, one that should be addressed by a jury.
You're in your rebuttal time if you want to save.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Gibson.
Good morning, Your Honors. First, I'd like to make a point about the distinction between role-playing games versus role-playing materials. I have to say I had understood Mr. Singer's appeal as focusing on his right to take part in the games as well as read the materials. So I'd just like to make a couple of points about that. This was a distinction addressed by the district court below, and Judge Stattmiller agreed with the Waupun administration's position that it's too difficult to police allowing inmates to possess these kind of materials but not try to play them on the sly. And I think that obviously is a rational connection. If you look at Singer's invoices for the role-playing materials he was ordering, it's apparent that his interest is not purely literary. If we go to the supplemental appendix, for example, SA 74, you can see that he's ordering all sorts of manuals, not just for Dungeons & Dragons, but for other role-playing games too. And these aren't just novels or something. These are trying to play the game. Finally, the affidavits on which Singer is relying so heavily speak about the virtues of role-playing games, not about just the virtues of role-playing reading.
Well, there's no evidence that Dungeons & Dragons has led to any violence, is there?
No, there is not.
Muraski's affidavit didn't point to any examples of where role-playing games have led to violence either, did he?
No. In fact, the evidence is that he said he was unaware of whether it had actually led to violence. But as the Farmer Court pointed out, prison administrators need not wait until there's an actual outbreak of violence to take precautions.
How far do you think that the prison can extend its concerns with materials that deal with the fantasy world? And I guess what I mean by that is, you know, could the prison ban all science fiction reading material, comic books, and all fiction on the ground that it would get inmates thinking about fantasy world?
I guess my view would be that to the extent the materials are intended and designed and structured purely as reading material, like a comic book, that generally if they pose no other dangers, for example, promoting violence, promoting certain views of women that are a danger to sex offenders, that I think at some point you get to a point where it's just reading material. And I think probably there are some good analogies with pornography and art materials that feature nudity. But here, we're not close to that line here, because what we're talking about here are materials that are used in an activity. And the structure of the activity features these components of, first, a leadership role for one of the participants, and second, an escapist fantasy component where the players actually imagine that they're someone else with specific powers, and then together they violently take on, you know, characters that they've defined as evil. Turning to Mr. Singer's affidavits, Mr. Singer essentially says that he has more affidavits than the defendants, but an inmate cannot create an issue for trial through the quantity of his affidavits. Singer's challenge to the WAPON policy focused on the first element of the Turner test, whether the policy bears a rational relationship to a legitimate governmental goal. So the question is whether he presented relevant evidence to disprove that there was that rational relationship. Singer's evidence just doesn't do that work. When we look at what's actually in the affidavits rather than just the number of them, we see that these kinds of statements in them fall into four categories: that the affiants had never heard of a specific Dungeons & Dragons gang, that role-playing games don't advocate violence or gambling, that role-playing games encourage certain skills such as math, reading, and teamwork, and that they were unaware of any actual outbreak of violence. Even if you take these assertions as true, they create no issue for trial. Regarding the first two statements, this policy did not arise from a fear that inmates might form a specific Dungeons & Dragons gang, or that role-playing games explicitly promoted a particular agenda. Prison administrators expressed concern that the structure of the game could facilitate gang mentality and gang power, and that role-playing games could be used by inmates to form a gang under the guise of an innocuous activity. Regarding the asserted educational benefits of role-playing games, prison administrators did not ban the games because they had no potential benefits. Rather, they were concerned about the risks that the fantasy quality of role-playing games could lead to increased hostility and addictive escapism on the part of inmates. To the extent that the affiants implied they would not fall prey to these risks, they could not speak for the prison population as a whole. And Singer's materials leave this danger completely unaddressed. The affiant's statements that they were unaware of past violence was also irrelevant. And as I discussed before, the Farmer Court rejected that prison officials have to wait until violence actually erupts. While Pond's policy addresses a contextual problem, role-playing materials used recreationally by inmates in prison. So the affiant's statements about role-playing games on the outside, for example, Paul Cardwell's statement that role-playing has been a component of supervised psychiatric treatment, are irrelevant outside that context. The affiant's statements simply don't address whether WAPON's ban bears a rational relationship to prison goals of security and rehabilitation. And had they offered such an opinion, they would have been unqualified to give it. Captain Muraski was the only affiant with the training, experience, and knowledge to offer testimony regarding the potential effect of role-playing games on security and rehabilitation in the prison. None of the other affiants could or did hold themselves out as experts on running a prison. And I won't go over the cases in the brief, but the briefs make clear that a number of courts have concluded on summary judgment that a prohibition on role-playing materials satisfies Turner. Singer attempts to distinguish those cases on the premise that those prisoners submitted no competing affidavits. In Farmer, the court addressed the prisoner's affidavit, which was also that of Paul Cardwell, and concluded that it was irrelevant. The other cases just don't tell us whether the inmates submitted competing materials or not. But certainly none suggests that had the plaintiffs submitted affidavits from themselves and their fellow prisoners as to their views of role-playing games, summary judgment could have been avoided. Instead, the courts looked at the evidence submitted by the state to see if it was adequate to meet Turner, and finding that evidence plausible, they granted summary judgment. Singer also argues that even if his evidence had no impact on the case, the affidavit submitted by the defendants was too conclusory to be sufficient. And I think here he really reads Beard v. Banks from the perspective of Justice Ginsburg's dissent rather than of the majority in that case. In Beard, a Pennsylvania prison disallowed all newspapers and magazines, with certain exceptions, to certain prisoners. And the reason proffered was that it was an incentive for inmate growth. And Justice Ginsburg said, I think that's a little too anemic for summary judgment. But her opinion was the dissent. The Beard majority upheld the district court's grant of summary judgment based on that reason offered by the prison, with the plurality emphasizing that the court's inferences must accord deference to the views of prison authorities. And here in our case, Captain Maraski's affidavit provides significantly more articulation for the ban than did the rationale held sufficient in Beard. The affidavit describes specific aspects of role-playing games that raise concerns in a prison setting and link them to valid institutional goals. Singer may disagree with the professional judgment of WAPON administrators, but he has not created an issue for trial. Under the deferential standard of Turner, the district court correctly granted summary judgment to the state.
Mm-hmm.
Any more questions?
Thank you, Ms. Gibson. Anything further, Mr. Herbert?
Quickly, Your Honors, to respectfully disagree with Ms. Gibson, my reliance on Beard was from the majority. Beard makes clear that the reaffirmation of summary judgment is important, and that's the holding of the case. Secondly, the absence of prior disputes or violence is probative. Again, it may not survive under Turner. Again, it's not the relevant inquiry here. These cases that Ms. Gibson has referenced in the briefs in other jurisdictions where courts have upheld such prohibitions did so on much more robust record evidence. And, of course, that's what we have to look at. If Mr. Maraski was the only one qualified to talk about the potential gang-related activity associated with Dungeons & Dragons, he could have done so in a far more robust way, as is evident in these other cases, where the record evidence is far more developed and far more compelling. Here, his one reference to escapism, again, may be legitimate, but at summary judgment, that's not enough. It can't be a bare conclusion. And I will just quote, he says, and this is from paragraph 33 of his affidavit, he says, this type of game has been found to promote competitive hostility, violence, and addictive escape behavior, which can compromise not only the inmate's rehabilitation and effects of positive programming, but engender the public and jeopardize the safety and security of the institution. Now, that may be true, but there's no evidence of it. And I will rest on that, Your Honors. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Counsel. And Mr. Herbert, we appreciate your willingness and that of your law firm to accept the appointment in this case, and we appreciate your assistance to the court as well as your client.
I appreciate that.
The case is taken under advisement.